From Greensburg to Lebanon, Erie to Williamsport, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, Governor Josh Shapiro is set to deliver his annual budget address, and he has some big spending proposals. David Taylor and Stephen Bloom are here for a Capitol Watch discussion. And will Donald Trump become only the second president in U.S. history to serve two non-consecutive terms in the White House? I'll have a town hall commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to our Capitol Watch crew in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. Tis the season for groundhog analogies, so with apologies to Punxsutawney Phil, once again, the balance of power in the Pennsylvania House of Representatives depends on the outcome of a special election. Recall that the chamber is currently evenly split with 101 Republicans and 101 Democrats. That tie has led the Democratic leaders who currently control the chamber to remain in recess until late March while waiting the outcome and seating of the winner of a special election for a seat in Bucks County scheduled for February 13th. The seat was formerly held by John Galloway, a Democrat who resigned last year to become a magisterial district judge. State Democrats are pouring money into the candidacy of Jim Prokobiak, who faces Republican Candace Cabanis. Five seats in the chamber became open last year, all in heavily Democratic districts, which were then won by Democrats. The Bucks County seat is more competitive, but also on balance Democrat. The outcome will determine which party controls the chamber between now and the end of the legislative session in November. State Representative Mark Rossi, who briefly served as House Speaker last year, has announced that he is ending his campaign for State Auditor General and will retire from politics at the end of his current term. Rossi is the victim of child sexual abuse and said he is leaving politics to concentrate on his mental health. The battle over taxpayer-funded abortion will continue to be fought in Pennsylvania courts. The state Supreme Court has issued a ruling requiring the Commonwealth Court to hear a challenge to the constitutionality of a 1985 state law that prevents the use of Medicaid dollars to pay for abortions. Once again, the high court divided along partisan lines in issuing the decision. 24 Pennsylvania lawmakers have filed a federal civil rights complaint in the Middle District of Pennsylvania against President Joe Biden, Governor Josh Shapiro, and the Pennsylvania Department of State, alleging federal civil rights violations. The suit maintains there is no role for the president, governor, or any non-legislative executive officials to determine the manner of elections. Bureaucrats, along with the state Supreme Court, have meddled in election law in recent years. State Representative Dawn Kiefer, who chairs the House Freedom Caucus, is the lead plaintiff in the case. She argues that, quote, the citizens of Pennsylvania have been victimized by extraordinary overreach of executive officials who have made changes to election laws with no authority to do so, end quote. That overreach has eroded voter confidence in the state's electoral process. The House Freedom Caucus wants the issue to be addressed prior to this November's elections. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. Governor Josh Shapiro will deliver his annual budget address to a joint session of the General Assembly this coming week. In advance of that, he has been trickling out plans for big spending on everything from education to mass transit. Our Capitol Watch crew is here to discuss. David Taylor from the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association is joined by Stephen Bloom of the Commonwealth Foundation.
And welcome once again to Capitol Watch, where we keep an eye on what's happening under the Capitol Dome in Harrisburg for you. I'm your host, David Taylor, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. With me in the studio, my main man, Steve Bloom, Vice President of the Commonwealth Foundation. Steve, great to see you.
Great to see you, David. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to be together, and we're going to miss our friend Rebecca from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association. She'll be back with us next time. But as for right now, we're looking at a very interesting and busy week in Harrisburg because it's time for the governor's budget address.
Yeah, Tuesday is the official address of the governor to the General Assembly on the budget. So it's the governor rolling out officially his budget proposal for the upcoming fiscal year. And there's a lot of quirks to this. There's a lot of tradition involved with this. The normal tradition is that the Senate members are invited to go to the House chamber where the House members are already seated. The Senate walks into the room, sits down on special chairs that have been prepared for them. And then the governor, His Excellency the governor, is announced. The governor comes in, much like the State of the Union address.
Yes.
Everyone politely applauds.
Honor guard.
Honor guard. Everyone, mm-hmm. He has an escort. Everyone applauds, stands, and then the governor takes the rostrum and begins his budget address. The budget address is typically the vision for the upcoming year from the governor.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you, we normally, this all, like I said, takes place traditionally in the House chamber.
Mm-hmm.
But as you might have heard, the House chamber is currently underwater.
Mm-hmm. They say.
They're calling it an aquarium. There's deep water everywhere. And they can't actually invite anyone over at all because they're so wet in the House chamber due to a roof leak.
Mm.
So while they're trying to fix this roof leak, which has already been, they've been working on it for several weeks, and they've got weeks and weeks to go.
Yes.
The business can't be conducted there. So the House is not coming into session. I understand that the governor will actually deliver his address in the rotunda, the main Capitol rotunda,
okay,
which is the big public space when you first walk in the front doors of the Capitol.
All right.
Normally, a lot of events take place there in rapid sequence, but nothing as formal as a budget address. So it'll be very curious just to see how this unfolds.
Yeah.
Will the public be allowed in the public's state Capitol building that normally is an opportunity for anyone to kind of be heard and give sort of political speech and statements and views? Now it's going to be locked down temporarily so the governor can give his address there. Unprecedented just in terms of structure and systems that are in place this time. So watching that part is going to be interesting. Taking place Tuesday again, this is happening.
Yeah.
But also, what is the governor going to say? And that's the more important part. What kind of proposals is Governor Shapiro going to roll out on his second budget as governor of Pennsylvania?
And we remember that the first budget sort of ended in controversy, and so the governor didn't get all of the bells and whistles that he was really looking for. What was passed was largely a scaled down spending plan that had earned the approval of the Senate Republican majority.
And first, the budget that was enacted was a partial budget,
right?
And there was a substantial impasse. Ultimately, as the months passed, the impasse was finally resolved right around the end of the year, but it was a 6-month delay, essentially.
Right.
So the budget was, for a first budget, it was not an easy go for Governor Shapiro.
Yes.
There were a lot of bumps, a lot of difficulties along the way. A budget got done, but even Governor Shapiro has publicly stated there was a lot of unfinished business left on the table.
Correct.
Some of those being very important things like major initiatives for school choice, like the Lifeline scholarships, past scholarships,
mm-hmm.
that would allow an educational savings account for children who were stuck in the worst performing schools. Other things like that the governor had talked about that he supports, but just didn't happen. So
right. We
believe the governor will be bringing to the table a lot of these unfinished business items, those and things that he and his team have dreamed up in the last year.
Yes, yes.
And so we're starting to hear a lot about it. We're starting to see a lot of reports of what may be in it. We don't know until he says it what's really going to be in the address. This week, he unveiled his economic development strategy.
Yes.
And he has a lot of hype and circumstance around it. It's a new strategy. It's a 10-year strategy. It was announced just recently. He's claiming that it's the first time in several cycles that a governor has proposed such a plan. My first reaction to it is a 10-year plan being proposed by the government. How's that going to work out? We've seen, it puts to mind the old visions of the
Politburo.
The Politburo in the Soviet Union. We're going to issue our next 10-year plan. And typically the 10-year plans resulted in starvation and destitution for the population.
Yes.
So, well, the governor is talking about investing in five sectors: agriculture, energy, life science, manufacturing, and robotics and technology. And he wants to do a number of things to spur activity in those arenas. And each one of them, again, comes with a price tag. He wants to invest in site development.
Mm-hmm.
He's been big on this. He's been talking a lot about this. He says other states have a lot more construction-ready or pad construction completed for industrial facilities that they're already permitted. They're already literally the the building is hooked up to utilities.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically a pad waiting for a structure to be built on top to do some sort of manufacturing activity. I don't know. I wanted to ask you, David, your thoughts on this, because when we're in a state that has got a uncompetitive corporate net tax in tax rate,
right,
is having a pre-built pad site going to be that consequential when a manufacturer considers, will I locate and invest in this state or a different state?
Well, so there are like two layers of challenge there. So the first layer, yes, is obviously we need to have stronger fundamentals to be able to pull down those investments. But at the second level, there are things that the Commonwealth can do and should do, especially with site prep. One of the things that we need the Commonwealth to do is to map out all of the available brownfields and redevelopment sites. We need to have a central catalog of those things and to document, you know, acreage, current condition, you know, the steps that would be necessary for remediation, if necessary, you know, access to rail, access to riverfront, all of those things that an investor would look for, so that we have a document for each one ready to hand to a potential investor who comes to DCED and says, hey, I need 3 acres with, you know, with rail access, you know, in this region of the Commonwealth, that the DCD can go, bam, right here, and here's everything that you need to know about that site, so that we're simplifying the process. We're not making the potential investor go to the county courthouse and do all the research on their own. It's a time-saving opportunity. It also shows that we're serious about earning the investment. The thing that makes me leery about sinking money into site prep is that I would think that you'd hang back and wait for an interest to be shown by a private sector developer to say, okay, this particular location geographically, acreage, other things, this meets our needs. We could build here. And then the Commonwealth would assist with getting those early stage things done for site prep. If you spend the money first and do the work first on sites where you don't know for certain that a private sector investment is going to happen, it just seems like there could be a wastage.
It ends up being a speculative venture.
Correct.
And it's putting taxpayer dollars at risk of being wasted.
Correct.
Because if there's no company that comes along that wants that particular type set of parameters.
Yes.
The site will go.
It could just sit there. They're addressing something that is important. I just don't think that this particular proposal is the right way to handle it.
Another part of the proposal sounds like it's going to be an item called Career Connect, which is sort of a small, relatively small. It requires money, new money, $2
yes.
million. Dollars.
Yes.
But that is apparently a small drop in the bucket compared to what we're already putting into the very things that this Career Connect would do.
We already spend, I think, over $2 billion a year, $2,000 million on job training and workforce development programs at state and federal taxpayer money. And, you know, it's a big tangle. It's a mess. We need to restructure the whole thing so that we can rationalize it and try to make it effective. Adding a new program, especially a comparably tiny little one, just to create a new brand name that the governor can repeat over and over and over again, seems to me just an exceptionally silly sort of thing to do.
And
you're listening to Capital Watch. I'm your host, David Taylor from PMA. With me, Steve Bloom from Commonwealth Foundation, and that we're doing prep on the governor's upcoming budget address.
One of the pieces of that Career Connect that interested me when I read the words that the governor associated with, or his team associated with it, to connect employers with workers, to help create internships, to keep young people in the state and enable every Pennsylvanian to secure a family-sustaining job. Well, those first two things, connecting employers with workers and creating internships, are typically things that would happen in the private sector anyway.
Correct.
I mean, we have, you know, everyone hears of all these websites where you can connect with employers, Indeed,
yes,
and so many others that are... They're advertising on TV all the time. You
yes.
hear about them constantly. They're allowing people to do this very thing
yes.
through private sector activity. There's not a government saying you must do this. There's a need in the marketplace for
yes.
employers
yes.
to be able to find employees and vice versa.
Yes.
So creating a new program for $2 million to help connect workers with employers and employers with workers, it seems to me
it's very much
venturing
like
into the private space.
Yeah, it's a drop in the bucket. I mean, it may be well-intentioned, but I mean, the workforce crisis is one of the most serious issues facing
absolutely
the private sector.
Yes.
And that, you know, that there are really serious problems of demography, of education, because again, we're one of the top spenders in America on public K-12, and you know, far, far too often our young people do not receive the educational experience that prepares them for success in the workplace. And there are, you know, any number of other, you know, societal and social factors and such. So it's like, yes, we need the chief executive and the executive branch to grapple with this issue, because it's a very, very serious one. But this sort of symbolism of a new brand and repeating the brand all over and over, it just strikes me as being advertising.
Another part of what the governor seems to be talking about in his pre-budget address conversation with the media and with people around the state is this sense that if we want to do better, we're going to have to do better than New York and New Jersey in terms of committing resources to economic development. Now, you know, we look at role model states. We look at population, for example. Where are people moving?
Mm-hmm.
People are moving out of New York.
Correct.
People are moving to North Carolina.
Correct.
Florida.
Yes.
Arizona, places with a favorable tax and regulatory environment.
Yes.
If the model that the governor is trying to compare us to and competing is New York and New Jersey, then he's really not challenging Pennsylvania to rise to the top.
Yeah.
It's more of a let's get slightly less mediocre.
Yes.
When you pick an opponent to try to beat like New York and New Jersey, it's not the aspiration we should be seeking.
That's correct. And he also has the wrong metric. Talking about the amount of money spent by the economic development agencies in those states. Well, yes, there are things that DCED needs to do. Yes, DCED has taken a lot of cuts. Should DCED have more money so that it can do more things? Probably yes, but it depends on how well the money is spent. It depends on what the money is spent on. And, you know, for far too long that Pennsylvania has over-relied on taxpayer-funded, government-directed economic development strategy, and that's not what we need. That's not what works. What we need, as I said before, was stronger economic fundamentals. We need to hammer down the baseline costs of creating and keeping jobs in Pennsylvania. I mean, one of the things the governor says is talking about moving at the speed of business, and that is absolutely crucial to our success. We need to streamline permitting. We need to rationalize our regulatory regimen so that these rules are easy to follow, easy to comply with, and that the Commonwealth is a partner in compliance. That's what those high-performing states do. The state, you know, economic development agency actually works with the potential investor and guides them through all the steps on how to fill out their paperwork, how to comply with law, how to get that permit, get it in their hands, get them going so that, again, that the shovel can turn over dirt and that the process can begin.
And meanwhile, Pennsylvania's entrenched bureaucracy is so mired in this slow, antagonistic, inefficient process of reviewing proposals, for example, for construction permits and environmental permits and even highway permits. There's things that should be rote that the state should say, here's how you must do it. Here's the parameters.
Go do it that way.
Go do it,
yes.
And we'll inspect it. And if it looks like what we asked for, you're good.
Yes.
That's how many states do it. And the presumption is it's going to be good unless there's a problem.
Right.
Pennsylvania almost seems like they're putting problems first and discouraging people from even going through the process. It's so overwhelming and so inefficient and expensive.
The governor also has a Main Street Matters program.
It's a relatively small amount of cash taxpayer dollars.
Mm-hmm.
But what does it mean to sprinkle $25 million across the state of Pennsylvania to small towns and downtowns? And it's not going to make any major difference. It's sort of a waving at the problem and saying, here, we'll send you some more money,
right,
but not really going to fix anything.
One of the things he talks about is helping with startups. Well, if you want to help with startups, you need to fix the tax law about operating losses. Mm-hmm. Like Pennsylvania is an extreme outlier by having a cap on the amount of past losses you can bring forward to offset against your current and near future tax liability. Startups are the ones who need to take advantage of that tax policy to write off the early losses. If we stay the way we are, we will continue to not have startup businesses happen here because, again, investors will not put their money in one of the only places in America where you can't use the fullness of those losses in the early going.
And instead of generating prosperity, it's going to start to interfere with our ability to fight the budget deficit that already exists in Pennsylvania.
Yes.
And is forecast to grow up to $4 billion over the next year and a half. So
yes.
If the budget doesn't fix anything—
Right.
Drives up the deficit and just sprinkles money around. It's not going to get done what we need to have done in Pennsylvania become competitive.
Sadly so. So this is, I mean, I wish I could say I was surprised, but this is, in a lot of ways, this is standard operating procedure. And, you know, maybe there are a few extra, you know, bells and whistles and gewgaws that Governor Shapiro will bring forward. But we need to do the difficult and unglamorous work of attacking those fundamentals. And one of those fundamentals is restraining state spending so that the politicians don't spend money faster than people can earn it. And that's another place where in Pennsylvania we've done a pretty poor job over time.
Indeed. And so we'll all be listening.
Oh, yeah.
And we'll all be curious to hear what the governor has to say on Tuesday. And we'll hope for the best, but be prepared for the worst and continue to be the watchdogs we need to be.
Absolutely, yes. And as the listeners always hear me say, choose to live life with your brain turned on. Choose to be engaged with the public policy process. Exercise your citizenship. Pay attention to what's going on. And certainly, Steve and I appreciate your time spent here with us. We're coming down to the end of it. Steve, where can people go to learn more about you and your group and the things that you do?
They can visit commonwealthfoundation.org on the web.
Outstanding. And as always, you can find me online at pamanufacturers.org. And from Steve and me, thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you next time on Capital Watch. And now, a town hall commentary from Loman Henry.
Thank you, David. Donald Trump has dominated the American political scene since the moment he rode down that now famous Trump Tower escalator to announce his presidential candidacy in 2015. That domination continues, and he now has the opportunity to do something only one other person in all of U.S. history has done, be elected to serve two non-consecutive presidential terms. That Donald Trump will likely be nominated by the Republican Party for the third time also puts him in rare presidential company. Only Franklin Roosevelt was nominated four times, this coming prior to ratification of the 22nd Amendment in 1951, which limited presidents to two terms. Roosevelt won a fourth term in 1944. He died shortly thereafter, being succeeded in office by Harry S. Truman. William Jennings Bryan was nominated by the Democrats in 1896, 1900, and 1908, losing twice to William McKinley and once to William Howard Taft. Andrew Jackson was nominated in 1824, losing to John Quincy Adams, before again being nominated and winning the White House in 1828 and 1832. Richard M. Nixon also was nominated three times, first in 1960, suffering a narrow loss to John F. Kennedy, and then winning the presidency in 1968 and 1972. Former President Theodore Roosevelt attempted a White House comeback in 1912. He lost the Republican Party nomination to incumbent President William Howard Taft. Roosevelt subsequently formed the Bull Moose Party, divided the vote, and paved the way for Democrat Woodrow Wilson to oust Taft from office. This brings us to Grover Cleveland. Cleveland stands alone as the only U.S. president to serve two non-consecutive terms. He was first elected in 1884 as the 22nd president of the United States. Cleveland began his career in elective office as sheriff of Erie County, New York, before becoming mayor of Buffalo and then governor of the Empire State. As the presidential election of 1884 approached, Republicans were in disarray. President James A. Garfield had been assassinated, and Vice President Chester A. Arthur ascended to the presidency. Arthur was mostly noted for his patronage roles in New York City. He was selected as Garfield's running mate as a fence-mending concession to fractious New York power brokers. He became an accidental president when Garfield, less than a year in office, succumbed to gunshot wounds inflicted by his assassin. Arthur was defeated for nomination at the 1884 Republican National Convention by James C. Blaine. Blaine lost to Cleveland and the Democrats. Arthur died a year later. In 1888, Cleveland sought re-election, facing off against Republican Benjamin Harrison. Harrison was the grandson of William Henry Harrison, who had died just 1 month into his presidency. Cleveland won the popular vote but lost the electoral vote. That was only the second time in U.S. history that had occurred, the first being a few years earlier in 1876 when Rutherford B. Hayes was elected. It would not happen again until the 2000 presidential election when George W. Bush prevailed in the Electoral College over Al Gore. Donald Trump in 2016 also lost the popular vote but won the electoral vote. Undaunted, Grover Cleveland ran again in 1892 and in a rematch with Harrison, prevailed in both the popular and electoral votes to reclaim the White House. Thus he stands as the only president to serve two non-consecutive terms in office. So now, Donald Trump has the opportunity to accomplish what Teddy Roosevelt could not, become the second U.S. president to be elected to non-consecutive terms. At this point in the process, Trump appears poised to claim the 2024 Republican presidential nomination. Polls show yet another tight race with President Joe Biden, who is cruising to the Democratic Party nomination. What voters this November will get to decide is whether Trump joins Grover Cleveland or Teddy Roosevelt in the annals of American presidential history. With a Town Hall commentary, I'm Loman Henry. If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, lincolnradiojournal.com and lincolninstitute.org. The annual Pennsylvania Leadership Conference will be held April 4th through 6th at the Penn Harris Hotel and Convention Center near Harrisburg. This year's featured dinner speaker will be Judge Jeanine Pirro of Fox News, The Five. She will be joined by a wide range of state and national speakers and panelists, including Thomas Homan, who served as acting director of the U.S. Customs and Immigration Enforcement during the Trump administration. The three-day event will also include an expanded schedule of workshops. The Pennsylvania Leadership Conference is the nation's largest and longest running. This is our 35th year of the state-based conservative activist conferences in the nation. Get complete details and register for this year's Pennsylvania Leadership Conference at paleadershipconference.org. That's paleadershipconference.org. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania.